Welcome to another exciting episode of The NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of The NIDS View, the podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. And of course, you know, we hope to please you every week with our repartee and our discussion of a current event. And we were talking earlier about what we should talk about today, because there's been a number of different things going on. And we decided that we wanted to talk about sort of Ukraine and the war that's ongoing. And we, you know, sometimes we have a very specific article that we want to discuss, but not this week. This week, we're just talking in general terms about sort of where each of us sees the war. And of course, I'm joined by Curtis McGiffin, but this week, our resident scientist is not Jim Petrosky. It is John Swiegel. And John is, you know, John is a friend, and he spent much of his career at the National Labs, and then now, and he was, you know, he's a physicist by training, and so he'll be our resident technical guy to talk, give, you know, that different perspective than Curtis or I give. And so welcome into the NIDS View. Thanks for being
John
here.
He's a fellow here.
He is. You know, that's the great thing about having lots of retired guys is, you know, they're affordable. So that's one of the great things. Now, you can tell jokes, John. That's one thing I didn't tell you ahead of time is jokes are okay. So you can be funny in this discussion. Oh. Yeah, so that's
okay. How about bad language? Are we good on that?
We try to keep it a little clean. Oh. We are the virtual retirement home for, scientists and political scientists. So
or
feel right here.
Yeah. I think we prefer to be called the La Brea Tar Pits of retired guys for, you know, we're the La Brea Tar Pit think tank. We're old, you know, officers and scientists come to die, you know, and they help, expand the pool of fossil fuels because that's just crushed dinosaur bones. Right. So, okay. So our topic for this week was the war in Ukraine. And there's been a couple of things, you know, going on over the last week or two. Russia has said they've changed their nuclear policy. The Ukrainians have invaded the Kursk region of Russia and have taken it. And Volodymyr Zelensky has said, we're going to keep this territory ostensibly for, you know, negotiating what Russian withdrawal, but we'll see. So there's a lot going. The Ukrainians have a new weapon that's sort of a drone / cruise missile, and they're attacking Russian air bases in Russia. So there's a lot going on. And so before we sort of move on, I wanted to, from each of you, as you sort of look at, you know, this war that's now, what, 2 years and 2.5 years. Yeah, it's 2.5. We're 2.5 years into it now. So it's, and there's no signs of it stopping. As you're looking at it, sort of what's your general takeaway or your general thought on, you know, not only just from the tactical sense of, you know, who's winning day to day, but from a much broader sense, how do you see this war and how do you see it playing out?
Who's that for, Adam?
Well, it's for either one of you, really. Oh.
All right, I'll kick us off here. John, it's great to see you again, and it's great to have you on the podcast. I may be wrong. Is this your inaugural landing here at the NIDS?
Oh, no. This is tour three.
Oh,
no,
okay.
This is the second or third. The earlier one featuring a comparison of deterrence to sumo wrestling.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
I must have been on assignment for that.
You can expect that from a scientist. So,
well, you know, it's all about mass times velocity and all that. So anywho, you know, hey, look, you know, the Ukraine war is still ongoing. There's a number of, I mean, there's so much to talk about, and it's going to be hard to go after any of it in too much detail. I think what I'd like our listeners to take away here at the very beginning is that just in general, when we look at war and conflict, like we see here with Ukraine or any other, you are looking at the failure of deterrence, right? And so when we at least initially, but we are also seeing the success of deterrence in the form of escalation management and the fact that the war hasn't gotten bigger, if you will, so to speak. It hasn't crossed geography to other countries. We'll talk about the invasion of Russia in a minute, but beyond that, it hasn't spilled over into NATO. It hasn't spilled over even into Russian allies. It also hasn't gotten. There's only been a very minor amounts of vertical escalation in the sense of intensity or raise. And for well over 2 years, the world has been worried and fretting over the idea that Putin might detonate a small nuclear weapon for a number of reasons. And we haven't seen that yet. So the threat continues to be enough, so to speak. And so when we think about this war, it's really easy to look at sort of the toll. And that's sort of what I want to go through here. I snapped a chalk line on this mid-August as I was preparing for another presentation. And, you know, it's of course, the numbers are really hard to capture, but I'll kind of just throw out what I have here in that. As of July of 2024, I think the United States estimates Russian casualties to be in the 350,000. The United Kingdom's Ministry of Defense has had estimates as high as 500,000. And The Economist recently put out an article that had estimates of Russian casualties somewhere between, and this is really an odd window, but I will give them credit, 462,000 to 728,000. So it's a pretty precise estimate with an interestingly large window. So it's really hard to gather just how much the Russians are suffering in the cost of this war.
That's the entire size of the U.S. Army. That's
yeah,
huge.
I mean, if you talk about it, 728,000 is the U.S. Army, more or less, active duty strength wise, and that's casualties, not deaths, but casualties. And so, understanding that this is just a huge toll, it's hard to count. And so forth. On the Ukrainian side, the numbers also vary. There was a recent speech by Secretary of Defense Austin where he said between 170 and 190,000 casualties on the Ukrainian side. Civilian casualties have been surprisingly small, 35,000 civilian casualties, of which 2,000 are believed to or have been marked as children. Of course, every death is a tragedy. We also want to note the millions of diaspora that has left Ukraine in the largest refugee crisis since World War II in Western Europe. Ukrainian aid, the U.S. has pledged or given something of along the lines of $177 billion, which is pretty close to the entire defense budget for 1 year for Russia. And then the Europeans have given another $120 billion. And the World Bank estimates that the damage to Ukraine, the cost to rebuild Ukraine infrastructure, is somewhere along the lines of $480 billion. And last year, I saw an estimate just to mitigate the environmental damage was somewhere in the $150 billion range. That would be in addition. So war is extremely expensive. And if you're an environmentalist, it's extremely destructive in that measure. And that is just one small section of the world that is suffering through this. So there's a lot of death and destruction on both sides. The key, though, is who can outlast the other. It is widely believed that Putin's theory of victory is to outlash or overcome pledged Western security assistance and Ukraine's ability to mobilize its economy and its population. At a population ratio 4-1, and a much larger economic base to draw from, Russia seems to have the advantage in a war of attrition, where Putin is, by all accounts, a recent piece from Foreign Affairs by Peter Schroeder, that Putin is all in, that there is no changing his mind, and that there's really only two ways to end this war. And I'll bring that up later.
So now, how do you see it, John?
You know, if you were, I've looked in much less detail. I've been looking toward the Indo-Pacific more recently, but I find myself asking higher level questions because I'm looking at it in less detail. Is this the Spanish Civil War of the war to come? One could ask that question. Certainly, it is a war. I suspect if you look at our massive investment in sending weapons to the Ukrainians, it's telling us something. And what's the new program in the Pentagon? The one where they want to make cheaper weapons more quickly, bring them more quickly into the field. The name's escaping me at the moment. But people are learning lessons about how to make modern war. And it is changing the face of modern war. I hope we'll keep up with that. It's, you know, I read an interesting piece by Niall Ferguson over the weekend. A year ago, May 2023, interview with someone at Stanford. He's at the Hoover Institution. And Niall Ferguson said, quit worrying about whether or not you're in the second Cold War. You are. And I fear that indeed that's the case. So this war will be depleting for Russia. They're running, as I mentioned before we spoke, the fraction of GDP that they're devoting to the military right now is huge. People do that when they're at war. Got to be a lot worse than what the Ukrainians are going to be in a position of. A fresh start economically, but perhaps what survives this for them will be a much stronger nation in the long run if they can couple this war with cleaning up the corruption in their economy. So this is a hard way to get there. This is an awful way to get there. I look down the road. This has forced Finland and Sweden into NATO. This has created a situation in which ships going to St. Petersburg basically have to run the guns of NATO on either side of the Gulf of Finland, which, if you look at it closely, is quite shallow. And the Russians, people say, well, they're going to invade Estonia or somebody. What they've started to do is renew Tsarist era claims to islands in the Baltic. So I'm kind of looking at what does this mean for down the road? It's going to take the Russians a while, but you know, they have been rebuilding their defense industry and they've developed relationships with, you know, we talk all the time about the value of our allies who don't always seem to be able to pay enough of a fraction of GDP to defend themselves. But they've got enemies. They have found enemies of their enemies in Iran and North Korea, people who need money and people who are willing to expand their defense industry in those kinds of cheaper, lower level weapon systems that are expendable, and the kinds of weapon systems that at least are going to have to fill in the lower level between modern high-tech weaponry. And so I worry about simply the looking at the numbers, the ability of the Russians to prevail in a long-term war of attrition. That worries me. Now, at least they pushed the Baltic fleet back from Crimea. That ain't bad. And the Ukrainians are still apparently shipping grain, right, across the Western Black Sea. Thank God for that. So yeah,
it is kind of a mixed bag, you know, where there's Ukrainian successes, Russian successes. Everybody seems to commonly share a belief that, you know, Vladimir Putin it's sort of a proud Russian tradition of, you know, taking more casualties than your enemy, but you eventually, you know, grind them down. And then
these are national narratives. These are national narratives, like the, you know, Russian endurance or the long march for the Chinese, or even, you know, we have our own Gettysburg and Antietam, just had the anniversary of Antietam.
But, you know, I will say in slight disagreement with Curtis, I think that this conflict has definitely proven the utility of nuclear deterrence. Because the Russians have employed nuclear threats and coercion against us and NATO very effectively. I mean, if you look at the constraints that the Ukraine works with, you know, you can't shoot, you know, you can't use our weapons across the border. You can't do this. You got to, you know, the constraints that are on the Ukrainians when they receive support from us, it's pretty, you know, it's an example of why we're afraid of the Russians and this fact that it's in the front of our minds that, well, the Russians might use a nuke. The Russians might use a nuke. So, I mean, that's deterrence working. When in reality, there are some who have said, well, you know, let's just enable the Ukrainians to go win this war. But, you know, we're prolonging it. We're prolonging the suffering. We're prolonging the cost. We're doing all those things because we're deterred. And so deterrence is working.
But the Ukrainians have shot at the strategic airbase in southern Russia. Not much, but they've done it. They've crossed the border in the Kursk region. Look, it's 20 miles by 20 miles.
It's much more than that. Yeah,
it's more than that.
Yeah, it's much more than that. Yeah, the report
it's
right
500
now is,
square miles.
Yeah, it's 390 square miles, 1,000 square kilometers. It's 40% the size of Rhode Island. If you want
wait
to think
minute.
About it,
390 square miles.
Yeah,
we're back to 20 by 20, my friend. So, the scientist doing the bad guy scientist thing, math. So there is deterrence. There's another thing to bear in mind to me. And it's, if you want to compare how different administrations deal with nuclear deterrence, I recommend a close read of the 2018 and the 2022 nuclear posture reviews. Go in with a red highlighter and highlight in the 2022 nuclear posture reviews how many times the word escalation comes up. Because it comes up a lot more than it does in the 2018 one. This is a highly escalation sensitive administration. So we get a lot of discussion of escalation. We get a lot of response to the threat of nuclear use, perhaps in a different way than we would have with a different administration.
So yeah. So I don't know that I disagree with, or Adam disagrees with me. I'm a firm believer that nuclear deterrence is working in that regard. I am, though, becoming less of a believer that that Ukraine is less is being deterred enough not to use systems. I mean, obviously they've invaded Russia now. I can't confirm that they used American systems to cross into the Russian border, or Western. But I'm hard pressed to think that they didn't use American systems coming in there. But I could be wrong. I think to get to go back to John's point, though, on at least on the battleground, I think what the Ukrainian war has done, though, is it has really changed the character of war. It's really made the Western world really cognizant of the benefits and pitfalls of this point of view a drone usage and the ability to really personalize the war per se. It's become what I often refer to as it's a new version of trench warfare, except you're not in a trench. Like in the old World War I trench warfare, you were afraid to stick your head out of the trench because you would get, you know, machine gunned off by a Maxim machine gun and be killed. Now you're afraid to get out of the trench because a point of view, a drone will find you in some, Ukrainian 20-something will literally fly a hand grenade right at you and kill you. And so I think it's really changed the character of war. It's really restricted freedom of movement. We worked very hard, America did, to get those M1 tanks to the Ukrainians. And within a month or two of them being on the battlefield, they were all pulled from the battlefield because they weren't useful enough in the current character of war. I think there's this is largely becoming, you know, this sort of war of drones and missiles, and a war of artillery, and so we're seeing a lot of second and third order effects. John mentioned the idea that Sweden and Finland, you know, after 75 years of neutrality, post World War II neutrality, have come into NATO. That is a second and third order effect that Putin was not counting on. We've seen it work the other way. Now he has a relationship with North Korea that he didn't used to have. And we see a coming together, if you will, of this axis of autocracies, sort of really solidifying themselves and finding other ways to work together and become something more than they used to be, something bigger than the sum, you know, the sum bigger than their individual parts. And so I think we have a lot of things going on, and the risk of this kind of innovation, which, you know, depending on your perspective, you know, can be negative, is going to continue to grow. If the war is prolonged, you'll have this war innovation continue, which is going to wreak havoc on the future battlefields. You're going to see obviously more death and destruction and the cost of that to mitigate that. And finally, every day that you continue this war, you have the chance of a nuclear detonation continues. And so the deterrent effect to try to mitigate that is just a little bit harder every day. And so I think those are things to consider as we look forward. And when we see this this report over the holiday weekend here, the Labor Day weekend of 2024, that Russia is looking to change its nuclear doctrine because of the Western role in Ukraine, this idea that Putin thinks that the West is trying to inflict strategic defeat upon Russia through the Ukraine proxy, the incursion in early August into the Kursk region doesn't make Putin feel any better about that. So I think we're seeing a lot of these things sort of adding up to getting into a situation where Putin is going to arguably begin to lower the threshold and move forward. What does that mean to deterrence thinkers? It does make deterrence harder, but it doesn't make it impossible. And that's the key here, is that we just have to manage that escalation.
Let me ask you guys, I was reading an article earlier, and the article was a Ukraine focused article, but it was talking about the biggest winner from Ukraine and the biggest losers. And I think it would be, you know, many might agree that the biggest loser for sure is Ukraine. And then the Russians might be second, and then probably the United States is third. This war in Ukraine, some people thought, that we can finally, without even, you know, without us actually having to fight the Russians, we can break the Russians. It hasn't turned out that way. It's turned out to be expensive for us. It's turned out to demonstrate that we don't have the arsenals, that our weapon systems are not quite as capable, like you said, with the Abrams, that it's a new kind of war in many respects. And the Russians have suffered tremendous casualties. That, you know, the U.S. Army right now sits at 445,000, you know, soldiers. It's the smallest it's been in a long time. And they've lost, the Russians have lost that many. But I wonder, is the biggest winner here really the Chinese? And then sort of secondly to that, sort of on, if you want to say, like on the down low, are the North Koreans set to be the real biggest winner if the Russians start transferring, you know, special nuclear material to them so that they can dramatically increase the number of weapons? And maybe they transfer, because there's some hard parts to nuclear weapons too, like guidance systems and other things that the Russians are better at than the North Koreans. Maybe in the end, it might not be, they're smaller, but in the end, they might be the real biggest winner. How do you guys see it?
When wars like this break out and people start expending large amounts of money, when you've got a tripolar world, the winner is the country on the sidelines. I mean, yeah. I think you want to be on the sidelines. And I just read today, we're going to have to shut down our military transport ships because we can't crew them. And we're going to be, just as we're on the looking down the road at a very dangerous situation in the Indo-Pacific. We're looking at closing them down. The Chinese, in some sense, are winners. They're getting to learn the lessons, all the lessons, and none of the cost at their end. Now, it isn't cost-free. They are investing, and I don't have numbers, so I can't be quantitative about this. I believe they're investing in Russia and propping up Russia, but they're propping up Russia to do their wet work. And so that's not good. We need to learn lessons from this. We need to see how quickly the javelins that we supplied were used up. We need to look at the fact that we and our NATO allies are having trouble providing enough 155 millimeter shells for artillery. And we need to take the lesson of, because this is still a real battlefield war. I mean, we're nuclear guys and we're thinking about the thing that maybe is in the background, but artillery, there are those who've characterized the Russian military as an artillery with a backup infantry. Ships, we have to worry about the size of our Navy to be prepared for the Indo-Pacific. We could be a winner if we take the lessons. We're losers if we spend the money and don't take the lessons.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
It's a great point. And unfortunately, I think that's usually how it works. Who are the big winners? I agree. China is the big winner here. And North Korea is also a big winner here, especially if they do get the tech transfers that they've been promised. They've got a new relationship with Russia that they didn't used to have, including extended deterrence protection. Not so much that they need it, but, you know, England doesn't say no when they have it from us, even though they have their own nukes. And so I think those are big winners. I think those who profit, and in many ways, however you want to define it, off of prolonged warfare, you know, it's industry, those who have a political ideology that like this sort of intervention type of thing, and so they're going to do well. And I actually think, to some degree, despite all of the loss that Russia has suffered, they are actually winning more than they're losing. And let me explain that just a little bit. With Ukraine's invasion, as small as it is, into Russia, what that does is, no matter how hard you might want to, as an internal domestic audience, criticize your Putin leader, you don't want to be invaded either. And so you can harden, you can actually bring naysayers onto your side by saying, well, look, you may not like what I'm doing, but they just invaded us now. And so we have to band together. So nationalism benefits Putin tremendously. He has not suffered under economic sanctions. In fact, the United States has suffered from all of those economic sanctions, the devaluation of our dollar, the effort by the BRICS to de-dollarize a lot of the oil trade and other things are definitely going to – they're haunting us now. They're going to really haunt us in the future. And so those are challenges. This banding together of this axis of autocracies, this Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and all the other usual despots are going to become more and more empowered. And as we, if you will, beat these countries up, again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be, but I'm just saying this is it's a natural ramification of the effort. When you beat them up with the rules-based order, it is a natural tendency to want to reject that rules-based order. And if they reject that rules-based order, then there's no holding them accountable to anything, because they won't believe they have to be held to accountable, because their values are now different. They no longer share the same values or agree to play by the same rules. And so if they've rewritten their own rules, you can accuse them of anything you want. Just recently, Putin went to Mongolia. He has an international arrest warrant out for him. Mongolia is a signature of the ICC. Well, that, and this, the Roman statute, which is part of that, the Rome statute or something like that, that basically demands, that demands that you have to do the arrest and, for people who do these things. And they basically have said, Mongolia assigned, so, you know, a fairly passive government has basically said, we are not really going to follow a treaty that we've not only signed, we've ratified. And so we see this, there's this emboldenedness about flouting the rules-based order. And so there's a challenge here to that. And we in the West either need to figure out, are we going to try to reinstate the rules-based order, which will likely have to be by some sort of force, or are we going to acquiesce to a basically two-systemed world, and how are we going to function in that and operate? Because they simply just aren't going to play by our rules anymore, and it's going to get harder and harder to try to regulate it in that manner. So I think those are the challenges. So the real losers, the real winners are China, North Korea. The real loser is the rules-based order.
And I'd make a recommendation. The last time Putin visited China, I believe it was, he went to China, they issued a joint statement. Mm-hmm. If you read that joint statement carefully, in there is their template, top level, three to five bullet point statement of what their idea of a world order should be. And I think that we need significant, sometimes I think we need significant humility about what we call the rules-based order, mm-hmm. because I do think there are times where we slather on a number of things that go with the rules-based order. You know, it used to be the Pakistanis reached a point where they didn't want to take Saudi aid anymore because they were tired of the Wahhabist preachers mm-hmm. who necessarily came with it and destabilized what was a somewhat, certainly more than Saudi Arabia, secular ruling regime. So in this restatement of the world order is something that is an extremely big deal, and everyone should be asking. Starting question, you mentioned it, de-dollarizing. What if the dollar is not the world's reserve currency? You don't like the interest rate on your home loan? Mm-hmm. Add a half a point.
That's right.
Or a point. So this is an important thing that's in the background. I think we need to tighten up our definition of this world order that we mean to support, and think very carefully about the cracks that are forming. I mean, the iron bricks is India. Whose side are they on? They're on the side of India.
That's right.
And that's okay. We just have to deal with it.
Unfortunately, gents, we are out of time. We have gone over our time. I mean, it's probably okay if you have a DC commute, but if you're in other parts of the country, you've pulled into the office or you've pulled into the house and you've got to get inside. So we'll go ahead and end the show. And I did want to end the show just because this will be published, you know, it'll be up on September the 11th. And so we just wanted to remember September the 11th.
That's right.
I'm sure you guys remember. I remember exactly where I was and exactly what I was doing. It was one of the most momentous events. You know, it shaped all of our lives. I mean, Curtis, you were on NAOC when 9/11 happened, and I remember where I was. John, I'm sure you were taking a hot bath and drinking a glass of Pinot Grigio.
I was on the way to work, and I was in Intel, and so while everybody else is going home, I got to get to work.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but we want to remember that, and for all those who lost their lives in the event, and then the wars that came. And of course, thanks to you. Thanks, Curtis, for being here. Thanks, John, for being here. Great discussion. And for those of you that are listening, don't forget to, the website, Global Security Review, hit the Twitter feed, follow us on any of those social media or, GSR. And of course, thanks for listening to this episode of the NIDS View. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.